Thank you, Nathan. I began working for the Star Jeanette Foundation in July of 2001. I was excited to have landed a job in my hometown of Richmond, Indiana, using both of my impractical majors, music and history. I was hired to be the foundation's archivist. Little did I know that the seemingly innocuous title of archivist would soon have me facing a collection of 10,078 RPM phonograph records and around 200 Jeanette and subsidiary label recordings that had been stored in cardboard boxes stacked three deep in a basement for around 10 years. These records created the basis of the foundation's collection when I began the task of cataloging the Jeanettes and creating an inventory of the rest. The collection also included five pianos that were stored at the local community senior center. Since that July in 2001, the foundation's collection has grown to include around 800 Jeanette and subsidiary label recordings, three star-made phonographs, six star pianos, original and reproduced photographs, and a variety of paper artifacts. The foundation has digitally preserved 225 of these Jeanette 78s through a grant-funded project with Indiana University, and I found out a week ago Thursday that NARIS had accepted the foundation's application to digitize and make accessible another 400 recordings in our collection. I want to talk about my experience with the Star Jeanette Foundation's collection as representative of nascent sound archives in small communities. I'll start with an overview of the history of the Star Piano Company and Jeanette Records, and then provide some contextual information about the beginnings of the Star Jeanette Foundation, and finally highlight our collecting program, looking at the purpose of the collection, the ways in which we've grown the collection, how we've preserved the collection with limited resources, the importance of partnerships, the ways we've approached access to the collection, the importance of policy, and the importance of volunteers. The Star Piano Company provides an excellent representative slice of the development of American popular music from the late 19th century through the Depression, and played an important role in that development. As the means for disseminating popular music shifted from sheet music to player piano rolls to recorded music, the Star Piano Company added to its product offerings to keep up with the technology. During the same time period, industrialization, the growth of big business, and northern migration were helping the spread and development of uniquely American styles of popular music, including jazz, blues, country, and gospel. Urban and rural consumers were helping create a variety of markets for the music, and the Star Piano Company was well positioned to supply that demand. The company began as the Trazer Piano Company in 1872 and grew to incorporate with stock in 1893 as the Star Piano Company. Shortly after, the Star Piano Company added player pianos and piano rolls to the product line. There were Star Piano Company showrooms all across the country in every major city and many smaller Midwestern cities. In 1915, the company ventured into the new market for phonographs and phonograph records and built recording studios with acoustic equipment in New York City and Richmond, Indiana, shortly after launching a line of Star phonographs. The company eventually introduced an electrical process in 1926. Early on, the vertically cut recordings featured a green Star label, which was changed within 2 years of its introduction to a Jeanette label in order to help boost sales. The Star name was associated with pianos. The idea was that changing the name to Jeanette would increase revenue by limiting the association with Star pianos. The name Jeanette was selected to reflect the surname of the Jeanette family who owned the company. While the early Star Jeanette catalog featured marches, classical music, 19th century parlor songs, and then current Tin Pan Alley hits, in 1922 and 1923, Jeanette began to release jazz recordings. The Jeanettes were entrepreneurs, and the label would release or record anything that would generate a profit. As a result of this entrepreneurial spirit, the discerning ear of a company representative in the Star Piano Company showroom in Chicago, and the relationship with the Melrose Brothers Publishing Company, which was located in a building owned by the Jeanettes that also housed the Chicago Star Piano Company showroom, Jeanette made some of the most important recordings in early jazz. Some examples include King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band's first recording on the Jeanette label in 1923, Duke Ellington's first issued recording with Wilbur Sweatman's orchestra in 1924, Earl Hines' first recording with Depi Serenaders in 1923, and other people to record for the label include Fats Waller, Bix Beiderbecke, the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, Jelly Roll Morton, Hoagy Carmichael, and Fletcher Henderson. The list goes on and on. I've created a brief montage of some of these recordings for an example. I hope you enjoy it. I can tell you later if you're interested in what those examples were if you didn't recognize them. The label's success with early jazz helped lead to the company's decision to begin to focus on early blues, country, and gospel music. Labels like Black Patty and Champion were introduced as subsidiaries of the main Jeanette label for the race and hillbilly markets. Some examples of early blues artists to record for the company include Big Bill Brunsey, Cryin' Sam Collins, Scrapper Blackwell, Georgia Tom, who's better known as Thomas A. Dorsey, the father of gospel music, Sleepy John Estes, and the Mississippi Sheiks, just to name a few. Some examples of early country artists to record for the company include Fiddlin' Doc Roberts, Ernest Stoneman, Vernon Dalhart, Gene Autry, and Uncle Dave Macon. I've created an example of some of the artists in these styles, similar to the first example I played.
Thank you. pounding in my breast when I lay down to take my rest. Oh, what a feeling that am. Horrid nightmares, scary dreams, then the blue steps on the scene. Oh, what a wreck I am. Oh, maybe it's the blue that keeps me worried all the time. If I could see these weary blues that's on my mind. Happiness that comes around but never comes to stay. If I only had someone just to dry my tears away.
Gang of brown skin, sweet women, got a gang of high yellows too, and I hope someday she'll learn to love daddy too. Ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-la-ski-da-
The company continued to record and issue popular song and classical music, and also introduced ethnic recordings, spoken word recordings featuring historic figures like William Jennings Bryan, and a whole slew of personal recordings for anyone that had the money that wanted to make a record. The company also made sound effects records. 1934 was the last year for commercial recording activity with the Star Piano Company, but they continued to make sound effects records and pianos until 1952, when the main branch of the Star Piano Company in Richmond, Indiana was sold at auction. The Pacific Division continued to manufacture refrigeration supplies and has developed into Refrigeration Supply Distributors Total Control, which is still owned by Jeanette descendants in California. Today, the former site of the Star Piano Company's headquarters in the Jeanette Studio in Richmond is in ruins, with only one shell of a building and a smokestack still standing out of the 20 acres or so of buildings once devoted to creating Star products. Pictures of the site are featured on the front page of one of the newsletters I've left copies of for anyone who's interested. The newsletters and brochures are on a chair in the back of the room. The Star Jeanette Foundation was incorporated in 1991 by a group of local jazz enthusiasts who organized to preserve Richmond's jazz heritage. The original mission of the organization was to develop a jazz museum on the former site of the factory and work with the City of Richmond's Department of Parks and Recreation, which currently owns the site and is developing a high-quality recreational trail system through the area. In 1998, the foundation's board grew to include more community leaders who initiated a fund drive that generated over $200,000 in local funding, which enabled the board to hire the foundation's first staff person in 2000. Currently, our facilities are all donated. Our tax-exempt status is through an umbrella organization, and I'm the only full-time salaried employee. Since 1998, the foundation's efforts have included the establishment of an informational website, which is currently getting a facelift, hosting numerous public events, creating a membership program, producing a biannual newsletter and a line of merchandise, in addition to increasing attention to our collection. Our basis for collecting Jeanette and subsidiary label recordings has always been with two purposes in mind: creating a museum and creating an archives. The current purposes are more specifically to create a complete archive of Jeanette and subsidiary label recordings, and to establish a collection of artifacts beyond sound recordings to be used in interpretive and educational displays. The development of the archive has recently been the focus of the foundation, but our past focus on creating a museum has influenced the ways the collection has been managed and grown. The dual focus is all-encompassing, but causes problems as we move forward. Obviously, defining the collection's purpose leads to the creation and implementation of policy, collections management practices, and the manner in which the collection is cataloged, stored, and made available to the public. One of the ways the goal of creating a museum has influenced the foundation's collection is in the way the recordings are cataloged. We use a museum system of cataloging, which makes it easy to catalog a wide variety of items, including pianos, phonographs, and other materials. An example of an issue we faced as a result of this dual purpose and the manner in which the recordings are cataloged can be seen in our partnership with Indiana University and the Archives of Traditional Music. The archive staff had to recatalog every single recording during our project with them because the foundation uses a museum rather than an archive standard. I'm extremely grateful to the Archives of Traditional Music's commitment to the project and willingness to work with the foundation during the tedious process. Ultimately, of more importance is the fact that 225 of our 78s were properly preserved and will be made available via the web, which is a humongous step forward for our organization. But having a dual purpose for a collection can be very problematic. In order to develop a legitimate archive and interpretive displays, our collection must grow. And it has been because of our increased attention to proper preservation and simply getting the word out. The major issues with growing the collection at such an early stage are not easy to overcome. With no permanent facility, no devoted staff person in charge of managing the collection, and limited funding, it's very difficult to add items to the collection in any great quantity. Most of our recent additions have been donated by supporters of the foundation, some of which are in this room. The ultimate goal would be to initiate a formal collections development program when more adequate resources are available through which to care for the items. In the meantime, we accept recordings since we have the ability to make them accessible and properly care for them. Another way we've planned for the future growth of the foundation's collection is by keeping record of potential donors. For example, our membership application provides space for members to list items that might be donated to the foundation in the future. We're also currently working, as I mentioned, to establish collecting priorities to better focus our collection to the foundation's collecting goals. Tied into growing the collection is the ability to care for the artifacts. As the foundation's capability to properly preserve records has increased, so has the number of donated items. The issue we face is that there is little training within our organization regarding proper audio preservation. Our solution has been to learn from partners. The most important relationship has been with Indiana University, through which we've learned archival preservation standards, purchased digitization lab equipment, and trained a local audio engineer to transfer the 78s to digital media. The outcome is the digital preservation of 225 of our recordings, as I've been mentioning. I'm going to play a sample from the collection featuring Art Landry's Call of the North Orchestra playing Ripsaw Blues, which was recorded in Richmond in June of 1923. And I'll have to cut this short because I think I'm running out of time.
Thank you.
Other examples of partner organizations that we've worked with include the Indiana Historical Society, which hosts free workshops on preserving collections with limited resources. Also, Richmond's Public Library has proven to be a good partner, as they've agreed to store the Foundation's collection of preserved 78s in their closed stacks. Access to our collection must increase in order to realize the purposes for the collection, which are becoming a legitimate sound archive and generating interpretive exhibits. Again, the major issue when talking about access to the collection is the lack of a permanent facility in which to house the collection. We've found a couple solutions. First, we exhibit our artifacts off-site in a local business where space has been donated for that purpose. And we also are going to be providing access to our preserved recordings online, first through Indiana University's network, and with the NARIS grant that we received, we'll be doing that ourselves. We also provide access to the collection through appointment, and a couple graduate researchers have visited the Foundation's office space and used the collection for their thesis work. Another way that we've approached our collection is through the development of policy, which limits future issues with the collection, creates consistency in management practices, and sets standards for long-term preservation. We currently have an acquisition policy with accompanying forms that guides our current collecting activity, and as I mentioned, we'll be generating prioritized collecting goals and a collections management policy in the near future. Volunteers have proven very helpful, as well as local students. Our cataloging is currently accomplished by local college students, and our partner in this process is Earlham College, which contributes 75% of the students' wages. It's a great deal for the Foundation. Cleaning has been done by volunteers, and I found that with training and written instruction, they can handle the job very well. We found volunteers in unlikely sources. We've used high school students, seniors, and even volunteers completing required community service. Important considerations when dealing with volunteers include conveying a sense of importance for the volunteer work, making sure that they understand the history of Jeanette Records and the Star Piano Company and why it's important, providing adequate training so that they properly handle the recordings, and being flexible when scheduling the volunteers. The Star Jeanette Foundation struggles to grow as a collecting organization, but provides some helpful examples of both good and bad ways to launch a sound archive. Issues the foundation deals with include establishing a clear and informed purpose for the collection, which helps guide the development and implementation of policy and collections management practices. When working with inadequate resources, partnerships and volunteer support are good ways to overcome limited finances. The Foundation has been able to grow its collection and continues its work to properly preserve its sound recordings by roughly following this process. Now, if we could only get a permanent facility, I'd stop my moaning. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. If we might have time for a quick question or two.
Mike? Who holds the copyrights on Jeanette Recordings?
The question I was afraid of. from what we know, and we've done a fair amount of research, much needs to be done yet. We believe that the Jeanette family still owns some of the copyrights technically. Decca Records bought some of the rights, however, many of those records have been lost. I've actually seen some of the documentation at Rutgers, so the company doesn't have it in their files. And other than that, your guess is as good as mine. We've had some limited contact with them. We also have worked with the folks down at Tulane, which have some good artifacts. And I mentioned Rutgers. I made a trip out there last May. But we're trying to keep track of the other repositories that have a sizable Jeanette collection. I'm not entirely prepared to answer these questions. However, from what I understand, Fantasy Records might be our biggest potential sewer, and we are in...
They're in the process of going down the sewer. You hear they're selling out.
But we're... No, and we're in the good graces. I mean, we've had contact with Warren Keep News, and he supports a lot of our efforts. So I think we're in good shape.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth.